courage to drive along it. Tall, pale sea grasses grew each side, shivering as the wind rushed through. The higher she went, the more mizzle seemed to hang in the air. Cassandra glanced at her watch. She'd underestimated how long it would take to reach the top, not to mention the weariness that would turn her legs to jelly midway up. Jet lag and good old-fashioned lack of sleep. She'd slept terribly the night before. The room, the bed, were both comfortable enough, but she'd been plagued with strange dreams, the sort that lingered upon waking, but slithered away from memory as she tried to grasp them. Only the tendrils of discomfort remained. At some point during the night, she'd been woken by a more material cause. A noise like the sound of a key in her bedroom door. She'd been sure that's what it was, the insertion and jiggling as the person on the other side tried to make it turn. But when she'd mentioned it at the front desk this morning, the girl had looked at her strangely, before saying in a rather chilly voice that the hotel used key cards, not metal keys. What she'd heard was only the wind toying with the old brass fitting. Cassandra started up the hill again. It couldn't be much further. The woman in the village grocery shop had said it was only a 20-minute walk, and she'd been climbing now for 30. She rounded a corner and saw a red car pulled over by the side of the road. A man and woman stood watching her. He was tall and thin, while she was short and stout. For a moment, Cassandra thought they might be sightseers enjoying the view, but when each lifted a hand in unison and waved, she knew who they must be. "Hello there," called the man, coming towards her. He was middle-aged, though his hair and beard, white as icing sugar, gave the initial impression of a much older face. "You must be Cassandra. I'm Henry Jameson, and this," he indicated the beaming woman, "is my wife, Robin."
"Lovely to meet you," said Robin, hot on her husband's heels.
Her graying hair was cut in a neat bob that grazed cheeks pink and polished and plump as apples. Cassandra smiled. "Thanks for meeting me on a Saturday. I really appreciate it."
"Nonsense." Henry ran a hand across his head to tidy fine, wind-blown hairs. "No trouble at all. I only hope you don't mind Robin coming along."
"Of course she doesn't.
Why would she mind?" said Robin.
"You don't mind, do you?" Cassandra shook her head.
"What did I tell you? She doesn't mind a bit."
Robin clutched Cassandra's wrist.
"Not that he had any chance of stopping me. He'd have been risking the divorce courts if he'd so much as tried. My wife is the secretary of the local historical society," Henry said, a hint of apology threading through his voice. "I've published a number of little booklets on the area. Histories, mainly, about local families, important landmarks, great houses. My most recent is about the smuggling trade. We're actually in the middle of putting all of the articles onto a website. It's her sworn aim to take tea in every stately home in the county. But I've lived in this village all my life, and I've never so much as set foot inside the old place."
Robin smiled so that her cheeks shone.
"I don't mind telling you. I'm about as curious as a cat." "We would never have guessed, my love," said Henry wearily, indicating the hill. "We have to go on foot from here. The road goes no further."
Robin led the way, striding purposefully along the narrow path of windswept grass. As they climbed higher, Cassandra began to notice the birds. Masses of tiny brown swallows calling to one another as they scuttled from one spindly branch to another. She had the oddest sensation of being watched. as if the birds were jostling to keep an eye on the human interlopers. She shivered a little, then admonished herself for being childish, inventing mystery where only atmosphere existed.
"It was my father who handled the sale to your grandmother," said Henry, shortening his long strides to walk just behind Cassandra. "Back in 75. I'd just started with the firm as a junior conveyancer, but I remember the sale."
"Everyone remembers the sale," called Robin. "It was the last part of the old estate to go. There were folk in the village who swore the cottage would never be sold."
Cassandra looked out to sea. "Why is that? The house must have beautiful views." Henry glanced at Robin, who had stopped walking and was catching her breath, hand on the middle of her chest.
"Well, now, that's true enough," he said, "but..."
"There were bad stories about town," said Robin between pants, "rumours and the like, about the past."
"What sort of things?"
"Silly rumours," said Henry firmly. "Lots of nonsense, the sort you'd find in any English village."
"There was talk that it was haunted," Robin continued sotto voce.
Henry laughed. "Find me a house in Cornwall that isn't."
Robin rolled her pale blue eyes.
"My husband is a pragmatist."
"And my wife is a romantic," said Henry. "Cliff Cottage is stone and mortar, just like all the other houses in Tregenna. It's no more haunted than I am."
"And you call yourself a Cornishman?"
Robin tucked a strand of wayward hair behind her ear and squinted up at Cassandra.
"Do you believe in ghosts, Cassandra?"
"I don't think so." Cassandra thought of the strange feeling the birds had given her. "Not the sort that go bump in the night."
"Then you're a sensible girl," said Henry. "The only thing that's been in or out of Cliff Cottage in the past 30 years is the odd local lad out to give himself and his mates a fright."
Henry took a monogrammed handkerchief from his trouser pocket, folded it in half, and gave his forehead a pat.
"Come now, Robin dear. We'll be all day if we don't keep moving, and that sun's got a bite. A bit of leftover summer this week."
The steep incline and the narrowing track made further conversation difficult, and they walked the last 100 meters in silence. Wispy strands of pale grass shimmered as the wind sighed gently through. Finally, after passing through a clump of straggly shrubs, they reached a stone wall. It was at least 3 meters high, and seemed incongruous after they'd come so far without seeing a single man-made structure. An iron arch framed the entrance gate, and wiry tendrils of creeper had plaited themselves through, being calcified by time. A sign that must once have been attached to the gate now dangled by a corner. Pale green and brown lichen had grown scab-like across its surface, filling greedily the curly lettered grooves. Cassandra inclined her head to read the words. "Keep out, or the risk be all yours." "The wall is a relatively new addition," said Robin.
"By new, my wife means it's only 100 years old. The cottage must be 3 times that."
Henry cleared his throat.
"Now, you realize, don't you, that the old place is in a state of some disrepair?"
"I have a photograph." She pulled it from her handbag. He raised his eyebrows as he looked it over.
"Taken before the time of sale, I'd say. It's changed a bit since then. It's been untended, you see."
He extended his left arm to push aside the iron gate and motioned with his head.
"Shall we?"
A stone path led beneath an arbour of ancient roses with arthritic joints. The temperature cooled as they crossed the garden's threshold. The overall impression was one of darkness and gloom. And quiet. An odd, still quiet. Even the noise of the irrepressible sea seemed dulled in here. It was as if the grounds within the stone wall were asleep, waiting for something or someone to wake them.
"Cliff Cottage," said Henry, as they reached the path's end.
Cassandra's eyes widened. Before her was a huge tangle of brambles, thick and knotted. Ivy leaves, deep green and jagged, clung on all sides, stretching across the places where windows must be hidden. She would have been hard-pressed to make out the building that lay beneath the creepers, had she not known it was there. Henry coughed, apology again colouring his face.
"For sure, it's been left to its own devices."
"Nothing a good clean-up wouldn't fix," said Robin, with a forced cheerfulness that could have resurrected sunken ships. "No need for despondence. You've seen what they do on those renovation shows, haven't you? You get them in Australia?"
Cassandra nodded absently, trying to make out the roof line. "I'll let you do the honors," said Henry, reaching into his pocket to withdraw a key.
It was surprisingly heavy, long with a decorative end, a swirl of brass in a beautiful pattern. As she clasped it, Cassandra felt a flash of recognition. She'd held a key like this before. When, she wondered. In the antique stall? The image was so strong, but the memory wouldn't come. Cassandra stepped onto the stone tread by the door. She could see the lock, but a web of ivy had strung itself across the doorway.
"These ought to do the trick," said Robin, plucking a pair of secateurs from her handbag. "Don't look at me like that, dear," she said as Henry raised an eyebrow. "I'm a country girl. We're always prepared."
Cassandra took the proffered tool and snipped the strands, one by one. When they all hung loose, she paused a moment and ran her hand lightly over the salt-scarred wood of the door. A part of her was loath to proceed, content to linger a while on the threshold of knowledge. But when she glanced over her shoulder, both Henry and Robin nodded encouragement. She pushed the key into the lock and, using both hands, turned hard. The smell was the first thing to hit her, damp and fecund, and rich with animal droppings. Like the rainforests back home in Australia, whose canopies concealed a separate world of moist fertility. A closed ecosystem, wary of strangers. She took a tiny step inside the hall. The front door admitted enough light to reveal mossy flecks floating lazily in the stale air. Too light, too tired to fall. The floors were made of wood, and with each step, her shoes made soft, apologetic sounds. She came to the first room and peered around the door. It was dark, the windows coated by decades-old grime. As her eyes adjusted, Cassandra saw it was a kitchen. A pale wooden table with tapered legs stood at center, two cane chairs tucked obediently beneath. There was a black range set into an alcove on the far wall, cobwebs forming a furry curtain before it, and in the corner a spinning wheel was still threaded with a piece of dark wool.
"It's like a museum," whispered Robin, "only dustier."
"I don't think I'll be offering you a cup of tea any time soon," said Cassandra. Henry had wandered over beyond the spinning wheel and was pointing to a stone nook.
"There's a set of stairs over here."
A narrow flight ran up directly before turning abruptly at a small platform. Cassandra put her foot on the first step, testing its strength. Sturdy enough. Cautiously, she began climbing.
"Go carefully now,"
said Henry, following, hands hovering behind Cassandra's back in a vague, kindly attempt at protection. Cassandra reached the little platform and stopped.
"What is it?" said Henry.
"A tree. A huge tree, completely blocking the way. It's come right through the roof." Henry peered over her shoulder.
"I don't think Robin's secateurs are going to be much help," he said. "Not this time. You need a tree lopper."
He started back down the stairs.
"Any ideas, Robin? Who would you call to clear a fallen log?"
Cassandra followed him and arrived at the bottom as Robin said,
"Bobby Blake's lad ought to do the trick." "Local boy."
Henry nodded at Cassandra.
"Runs a landscaping business. Does most of the work up at the hotel, too, and you won't get a better recommendation than that."
"I'll give him a call, shall I?" said Robin. "Find out how he's placed later in the week. I'll just take myself out to the point and see if I can pick up mobile reception. Mine's been dead as a doorknob since we set foot in here."
Henry shook his head. "Over 100 years since Marconi received his signal, and now look where technology's taken us. You know, the signal was sent from just round the coast a little way. Poldhu Cove?"
"Was it?" As the extent of the cottage's dereliction dawned on her, Cassandra was beginning to feel increasingly overwhelmed. Grateful though she was to Henry for meeting her, she wasn't sure she'd be able to feign interest in a lecture on early telecommunications. She brushed aside a woven shawl of spider's web and leaned against the wall, offered him a stoic smile of polite encouragement. Henry seemed to sense her mood.
"I'm terribly sorry the cottage is in such a state," he said. "I can't help but feel some responsibility, being the solicitor in charge of the key."
"I'm sure there was nothing you could have done, particularly if Nell asked your father not to." She smiled. "Besides, it would have been trespassing, and the sign out front is pretty clear about that."
"True enough. And your grandmother was adamant about us not calling in tradesmen. She said the house was very important to her, and she wanted to see to the restoration personally."
"I think she had plans to move here," said Cassandra. "For good."
"Yes," said Henry. "I had a look back over the old files when I knew I'd be meeting you this morning. All her letters mention coming here herself, until one written in early 1976. She said her circumstances had changed, and she wouldn't be back. Not for a time, at any rate. She asked my father to hold the key, though, so she'd know where to find it when the time came."
He looked around the room.
"But it never did."
"No," said Cassandra.
"But you're here now," Henry said with renewed enthusiasm.
"Yes." A noise at the door, and they both looked up.
"I got on to Michael," said Robin, tucking her phone away. "He said he'd pop over on Wednesday morning to see what needs doing."
She turned to Henry.
"Come now, my love. We're expected at Marsh's for lunch, and you know how she gets when we're late."
Henry raised his eyebrows.
"Our daughter has many virtues, but patience is not chief among them."
Cassandra smiled. "Thanks for everything."
"Now, don't you be thinking of trying to move that log yourself," he said, "no matter how keen you are to get a look upstairs."
"I promise." As they made their way along the path to the front gate, Robin turned back to Cassandra.
"You look like her, you know."
Cassandra blinked.
"Your grandmother. You have her eyes.
You met her?
Oh, yes, of course, even before she bought the cottage. One afternoon she came into the museum where I was working. She asked questions about local history, some of the old families in particular.
Henry's voice from the cliff edge. Come on, Robin, love. Marcia will never forgive us if the roast burns.
The Maltrichet family?
Robin waved at Henry.
That's them, the ones who used to live up at the Grand House. The Walkers, too. The painter and his wife, and the lady writer who published fairy tales.
Robin!
Yes, yes, I'm coming.
She rolled her eyes at Cassandra.
He's got about as much patience as a firecracker on a fire, that husband of mine.
And then she bustled after him, instructions for Cassandra to call on them any time, floating back after her on the sea breeze.
Chapter 25. Tregenna, 1975. The Tregenna Museum of Fishing and Smuggling was nestled in a small whitewashed building on the rim of the outer harbour, and though the handwritten sign posted in the front window was clear about the opening hours, Nell had been in the village for 3 days before she finally glimpsed a light inside. She turned the handle and pushed open the low, lace-draped door. Behind the desk sat a prim woman with shoulder-length brown hair. Younger than Leslie, thought Nell, but with a bearing infinitely older. The woman stood when she saw Nell, so that the tops of her legs pulled the lace cloth and a pile of papers towards her. She had the look of a child caught raiding the cake tin.
I wasn't expecting visitors, she said,
peering over the top of her large glasses. Nor did she seem particularly pleased to see any. Nell held out her hand. Nell Andrews. She glanced at the name plaque on the desk.
And you must be Robin Martin.
We don't get many visitors, not in the off-season. I'll just find the key. She worried the papers on the desk, tucked a strand of hair behind her ear.
The displays are a little dusty, she said, a note of accusation in her voice. But it's through that way.
Nell's gaze followed the sweep of Robin's arm. Beyond the closed glass door was a small adjoining room, host to various nets and hooks and rods. Black and white photographs had been hung upon the wall, boats and crews and local coves.
Actually, said Nell, I'm looking for particular information. The fellow at the post office thought you might be able to help.
My father.
Pardon me?
My father's the postmaster.
Yes, Nell said. Well, he thought you might be able to help me. The information I'm after isn't anything to do with fishing or smuggling, you see. It's local history. Family history, to be precise.
The change in Robin's countenance was instant.
Why ever didn't you say so? I work here at the Fishing Museum to do my bit for the community, but Tregenna's social history is my life. Here.
She riffled through the pieces of paper she'd been busy with on her desk and thrust one into Nell's hand.
This is the text for a tourist pamphlet I'm putting together, and I'm just finishing the draft of a little article on great houses. I've had interest from a publisher in Falmouth.
She looked at her fine, silver-chained wristwatch.
I'd be happy to speak with you, only I have to be somewhere.
Please, said Nell, I've come a long way, and I won't take much of your time. If you could just spare me a few minutes. Robin's lips tightened, and she fixed Nell with her mouse-like gaze.
I can do better than that, she said, nodding decisively. I'll take you with me. A thickening layer of fog had blown in with the high tide and conspired with dusk to leech the village of colour. As they climbed higher along the narrow streets, everything was turned a shade of grey. The swift change in conditions had brought an agitation to Robin's manner. She walked at a clipped pace so that Nell, despite her own naturally spruce gait, had to work to keep up. Though Nell wondered where it was they were going so fast, the pace was such an impediment to conversation that she couldn't ask. At the top of the street, they reached a little white house with a sign that read, Pilchard Cottage. Robin rapped on the door and waited. There were no lights on inside, and she lifted her wrist closer to her eyes to make out the time. Still not home. We tell him always to come home early when the fog sets in. Who? Robin glanced at Nell, as if she'd forgotten for a moment that the other woman was with her. Gump, my grandfather. He goes each day to watch the boats. He was a fisherman himself, you see. He's been retired 20 years, but he's not happy unless he knows who's been out and where they were catching. Her voice snagged. We tell him not to stay out when the fog's on the rise, but he won't be told. She broke off and squinted into the distance. Nell followed her gaze, watched as a patch of thick mist seemed to darken. A figure loomed towards them. Gump! Called Robin. No fuss, my girl, came a voice from the fog. No fuss. He appeared in the gloom, climbed his 3 concrete steps, and turned the key in the lock. Well, don't just stand there shivering like a pair of winnods, he said over his shoulder. Come on in, and we'll have a nice drop of warm. In the narrow hallway, Robin helped the old man out of his salt-encrusted Macintosh and black Wellington boots, then stowed them on a low wooden bench. You're damp, Gump, she fussed, clutching a handful of his checked shirt. Let's get you some dry clothes. Bah, said the old man, tapping his granddaughter's hand. I'll sit a time by the fire and be dry as a bone by the time you bring me some tea. Robin raised her eyebrows slightly in Nell's direction as Gump hobbled into the front room. Can you see what I have to deal with? Said the gesture. Gump's almost 90, but he refuses to move out of his house, she said quietly. Between us, we make sure someone has supper with him every night. I'm Monday to Wednesday. He seems well for 90. His eyesight's starting to fail, and his hearing isn't the best. But he still insists on making sure his boys get back safely into port. No thought for his own frailties. God help me if he comes to any harm on my watch. She peered through the glass, wincing as her grandfather tripped over the rug on his way to the armchair. I don't suppose, that is, I wonder whether you'd sit with him while I light the fire and put the kettle on. I'll feel better once he's all dried out. Lured by the exquisite promise of finally learning something of her family, there was little Nell wouldn't agree to. She nodded, and Robin smiled with relief before hurrying through the door after her grandfather. Gump had sat himself in the tan leather armchair, a homely quilt spread across his lap. For a moment, as she looked at that quilt, Nell thought of Lil and the quilt she'd made for each of her daughters. She wondered what her mother would think about this quest she was on, whether she'd understand why it was so important to Nell to reconstruct the first 4 years of her life. Probably not. Lil had always believed that a person's duty was to make the best of the hand they were dealt. No use wondering what might have been, she used to say. All that matters is what is. Which was all very well for Lil, who knew the truth about herself.
Robin pushed herself to standing, new flames leaping eagerly from paper to paper on the grate behind her.
"I'm going to fetch some tea now, Gump. Put the supper on to cook. While I'm in the kitchen, my friend here..." She looked searchingly at Nell. "I'm sorry. Nell. Nell Andrews. Nell is going to sit with you, Gump. She's a visitor to Tregenna and interested in the local families. Perhaps you can tell her a bit about the old town while I'm gone."
The old man held open palms, upon which a lifetime of hauling ropes and threading hooks had written its tale.
"Ask me anything," he said, "and I'll tell you all I know."
As Robin disappeared through a low doorway, Nell looked about for somewhere to sit. She settled on a green wing-backed chair by the fire, enjoying the surge of warmth as firelight yawned across her side. Gump looked up from the pipe he was busy loading and nodded his encouragement. Apparently the floor was hers. Nell cleared her throat and shifted her feet a little on the rug, wondering where to begin. She decided there was no point beating around the bush.
"It's the Mountrachet family I'm interested in."
Gump's match sizzled, and he puffed vigorously to start his pipe. "I've been asking about in the village, but it seems that no one knows anything about them."
"Oh, they know about them all right," he said on a smoky exhalation. "They just don't talk about them."
Nell's eyebrows lifted.
"Why is that?" "The folk in Tregenna like a good yarn, but we're a superstitious bunch, by and large. We'll chat happily on just about any subject you care to name, but ask about the happenings up there on the cliff, and people clam up."
"I noticed," said Nell. "Is it because the Mountrachets were titled aristocrats? Upper class?"
Gump snorted. "They had money. But don't you go talking about class."
He leaned forward.
"That was a title paid for by the spilled blood of innocence. 1724, it was. A wild storm blew up, late one afternoon, the fiercest in years. The lighthouse lost its roof, and the new oil lamp flame was snuffed out, as if it were little better than a candle. The moon was in hiding, and the night was black as my boots."
Pale lips tightened around his pipe. He sucked long and hard, warming to his tale.
"Most of the local fishing boats had come in early, but there was a single sloop still out in the strait, a double master with a foreign crew. The crew of that sloop never stood a chance. They say there were waves breaking halfway up the sharp stone cliffs, and she was thrown so hard against the rocks that she started to fall to pieces before she even reached the cove. There were newspaper reports and a government inquiry, but they never recovered much more than a few pieces of tattered red cedar from the hull. They blamed the local free traders, of course."
"Free traders?"
"Smugglers," said Robin, who had appeared with the tea tray. "But it wasn't them who stripped the ship of its cargo," said Gump. "No fear. It was the family that did it. The Mountrachet family."
Nell took a proffered cup from Robin.
"The Mountrachets were smugglers."
Gump laughed a dry, whiskery laugh and took a swig of tea.
"They were nothing so dignified as that. Smugglers do their share of liberating overtaxed items from ships that come to grief, but they also do their bit rescuing the crews. What happened that night in the Blackhurst Cove was the work of thieves. Thieves and murderers. They killed every single one of that crew, stole the cargo from her hull, then early next morning, before anyone had a chance to learn what had happened, they dragged the ship and its bodies out to sea and sank it. Made themselves a fortune. Crates of pearls and ivory, fans from China, jewelry from Spain. Over the next few years, Blackhurst underwent massive renovations. Robin took up the story, perching on the faded velvet of her grandfather's footstool. I've just been writing about it for my Great Houses of Cornwall pamphlet. That's when it acquired the third story and a number of the garden follies. And Mr. Mountrachet was given an ennoblement by the king. Amazing what a few well-chosen gifts can do. Nell shook her head and shifted uncomfortably. Now was not the time to mention that these murderers and thieves were her ancestors. To think they got away with it. Robin glanced at Gump, who cleared his throat.
Well, no, he muttered. I wouldn't say that.
Nell looked between them, confused.
There's worse punishments than those doled out by the law. Mark my words, there's worse punishments than that.
Gump exhaled through tight lips.
After what happened in the cove, the family up there was cursed. Every last one of them.
Nell leaned back against her seat, disappointed. A family curse. Right when she'd thought herself on the verge of actual information.
Tell her about the ship, Gump, said Robin, seeming to sense Nell's deflation.
The black ship.
Happy to oblige, Gump raised his volume a notch as a show of narrative commitment.
The family might have sunk that ship, but they couldn't rid themselves of her. Not for long. She still appears sometimes on the horizon, usually before or after a storm. A large black sloop, a phantom ship, stalking the cove, haunting the descendants of those responsible.
You've seen it? The ship? The old man shook his head.
I thought I might have once, but I was mistaken, thank God.
He leaned forward. It's an ill wind blows that ship into view.
They say a person who sights the phantom ship pays penance for its loss. If you see it, it sees you. And all I know is that those who admit to having seen it attract more ill fortune than anyone should bear. The sloop's proper name was the Jacquard, but around here we call it the Blackhurst.
Blackhurst Estate, said Nell. Not a coincidence, I take it.
She's a bright penny, said Gump, smiling around his pipe at Robin. A bright penny, this one. And there's some that would agree that's where the estate got its name.
Not you?
I've always thought it had more to do with the big black rock up there in the Blackhurst Cove. There is a passage, runs right the way through it, you know. It used to lead from the cove to somewhere on the estate and back into the village. A blessing for the smugglers, but a temperamental one at that. Something in the angles and shapes of the tunnel. If the tide rose higher than expected, a man inside the caves had little hope of survival. That rock's been hearse to plenty of brave souls over the years. If you've ever looked down onto the estate beach, you'll have seen it. Monstrous, jagged thing.
Nell shook her head.
I haven't seen the cove, not yet. I tried to visit the house yesterday, but the front gates were locked. I'm going back tomorrow to drop a letter of introduction in the letterbox. Hopefully the owners will let me take a look. Any idea what they're like?
New people, said Robin sagely. Out-of-towners. Talk of turning it into a hotel.
She leaned forward.
They say the young woman's a paperback writer. Romances and the like. She's very glamorous, and the books are quite racy.
Her gaze slipped sideways to her grandfather, and she flushed. Not that I've read them myself. I saw part of the property advertised in the estate agent's office in town, said Nell. A little house called Cliff Cottage is for sale.
Gump laughed dryly. And always will be. There is no one fool enough to buy it. Take more than a coat of paint to clear that place of all the misfortune that's seen.
What sort of misfortune? Gump, who had heretofore spun his stories with abounding relish, was suddenly silent, chewing over this last question. A flicker seemed to pass through his eyes.
That place should have been burned down years ago. There were things went on there that weren't right.
What sort of things?
Never you mind about that, he said, lips trembling. Just you take my word for it. There are some places can't be made new with a fresh coat of paint.
I didn't mean to buy it, said Nell, surprised by his vehemence. I just thought it might be a way of getting a look at the estate.
No need to go through the Blackhurst estate to get a look at the cove. You can see it from the cliff top.
He raised his pipe in the direction of the coast.
Take the path from the village up around the bluff and look towards Sharpstone. That's it below you. Prettiest little cove in all of Cornwall. Except for that brutish rock. No sign of the blood spilled across its beach long ago.
The smell of beef and rosemary had grown thick, and Robin fetched bowls and spoons from the kitchen.
You'll stay for supper, won't you, Nell? Course she will, said Gump, leaning back into his chair. Wouldn't think of sending her out on a night like this one. Black as your hat out there. And twice as thick.
The stew was delicious, and Nell took little convincing to have a second bowl. Afterwards, Robin excused herself to wash the dishes, and Nell and Gump were alone again. The room was warm now, and his cheeks red. He sensed her gaze and nodded convivially. There was something easy about William Martin's company. Something insulating about sitting in his front room. This was the power of the story weaver, Nell realized, an ability to conjure color so that all else seemed to fade. And William Martin was a born storyteller, there was little doubt about that. Just how much of his tales to believe was another question. He had an obvious gift for spinning straw into gold, but nonetheless, he was likely to be the only person she'd find who had lived through the years that interested her. I wonder, she said, fire warming her side so that it itched pleasingly. When you were younger, did you ever know Eliza Makepeace? She was a writer, the ward of Linus and Adeline Mountrachet. There was a perceptible pause. William's voice was whisker muffled.
Everyone knew of Eliza Makepeace.
Nell drew breath.
Finally.
Do you know what happened to her? She said, all in a rush. In the end, I mean. He shook his head.
I don't know that.
A new reticence had crept into the old man's bearing, a guardedness that had been absent until now. While the implications of this made her heart swell with hope, Nell knew she'd have to tread carefully. She didn't want to send him into his shell, not now. What about earlier, when she lived at Blackhurst? Can you tell me anything?
I said I knew of her. I had no occasion to know her well. I wasn't welcome at the big house. Those in charge up there would have had something to say about that.
Nell persisted. From what I can gather, Eliza was last seen in London in late 1913. She was with a small girl, Ivory Walker, who was almost 4 years old. Rose Mountrachet's daughter. Can you think of any reason at all, why Eliza might have been planning a trip to Australia with someone else's child?
No.
Any idea why the Mountrachet family might have told people their granddaughter was dead when she was very much alive? The reed of his voice split.
No.
So you knew that Ivory was alive, despite contrary reports? The fire crackled.
I didn't know that, because it isn't so. That child died of scarlet fever.
Yes, I know that's what was said at the time. Nell's face was warm, her head throbbing. I also know that it's not true.
How would you know a thing like that?
Because I was that child. Nell's voice cracked. I arrived in Australia when I was 4, was put on a boat by Eliza Makepeace when everyone thought that I was dead, and no one seems to be able to tell me why. William's expression was difficult to interpret. He seemed about to answer, but didn't. Instead, he rose, stretched out his arms so that his belly thrust forward.
"I'm tired," he said gruffly. "It's about time I went up to my bed."
He called out,
"Robin?"
And again, louder,
"Robin!"
"Gump?" Robin returned from the kitchen, tea towel in hand. "What is it?"
"I'm turning in."
He started for the narrow stairs that curved an exit path from the room.
"You don't want another cup of tea? We were having such a nice time."
William placed his hand on Robin's shoulder as he passed her.
"Put the wood in the hole on your way out, won't you, my girl? We don't want the mist settling inside."
As bewilderment widened Robin's eyes, Nell fetched her own coat. "I should go."
"I'm very sorry," said Robin. "I don't know what's come over him. He's old. He gets tired."
"Of course." Nell finished doing up her buttons. She knew she should apologize. It was her fault, after all, that the old man had been upset, and yet she couldn't. Disappointment sat like a wedge of lemon in her throat. "Thank you for your time," she managed to say, stepping out of the front door and into the oppressive damp. Nell glanced back when she reached the bottom of the hill and saw that Robin was still watching. She raised an arm to wave when the other woman did so. William Martin may have been old and tired, but there was more to his sudden departure than that. Nell ought to know. She had held on to her own thorny secret long enough to recognize a fellow sufferer. William knew more than he was letting on, and Nell's need to uncover the truth outranked her respect for his privacy. She pressed her lips together and bowed her head against the cold, determined to convince him into telling her all he knew. Chapter 26. Blackhurst Manor, 1900. Eliza was right. The name Rose was well suited to a fairy tale princess. And certainly Rose Mountrachet enjoyed the uncommon privilege and beauty befitting the part. Sadly, though, for little Rose, the first 11 years of life had been anything but a fairy story.
"Open wide,"
Dr. Matthews plucked a reedy paddle from his leather bag and flattened Rose's tongue. He leaned forward to peer down her throat, his face so close that she was granted an unwelcome opportunity to conduct reciprocal inspection of his nasal hairs. He said, setting the hairs to quivering. Rose coughed weakly as the retracting paddle scraped her throat.
"Well, Doctor?"
Mama stepped from the shadow, tapered fingers pale against her deep blue dress. Dr. Matthews stood to full height.
"You did well to call, Lady Mountrachet. There is indeed an inflammation."
Mama sighed.
"I thought as much. You have a preparation, Doctor?"
As Dr. Matthews outlined his recommended mode of treatment, Rose turned her head to the side and closed her eyes, yawned lightly. For as long as she could remember, she'd known she wasn't long for this world. Sometimes, in weaker moments, Rose allowed herself to imagine what life might be like if she didn't know her end, if the future stretched before her indefinitely, a long road with twists and turns she couldn't anticipate. With milestones that might include a society debut, a husband, children, a grand home of her own with which to impress other ladies. For, oh, if she were honest, how earnestly she longed for such a life. She didn't let herself imagine this too often, though. What use was there in lamenting? Instead, she waited, convalesced, worked on her scrapbook. Read, when she was able, of places she'd never see, and facts she'd never use, in conversations she'd never have. Waiting for the next inevitable episode that brought her closer to the end, hoping that the next ailment might be a little more interesting than the last. Something with less pain and more reward, like the time she'd swallowed Mama's thimble. She hadn't meant to, of course. If it hadn't been so shiny, so pretty in its silver acorn holder, she wouldn't have thought to touch it. But it had, and she did. What 8-year-old would have done differently? She'd been trying to balance it on the tip of her tongue, somewhat like the clown in her Meggendorfer circus book, the one who balanced the red ball on his silly pointed nose. Inadvisable, certainly, but she'd only been a child, and besides, had been performing the feat for some months without mishap. The thimble episode had turned out pretty well, by all accounts. The doctor had been called immediately, a new young physician who'd only recently taken over the village practice. He'd poked and prodded and done what doctors do, before making quivering suggestion that a certain new diagnostic tool might be of some use. By taking a photographic exposure, he'd be able to look right within Rose's stomach without so much as lifting a scalpel. Everyone had been pleased with this suggestion. Father, whose skill with a camera meant he was called upon to take the modern exposure. Dr. Matthews, because he was able to publish the photographs in a special journal called The Lancet. And Mama, because the publication sent a ripple of excitement through her society circles. As for Rose, the thimble was passed, most indecorously, some 48 hours later, and she was able to bask in the certain knowledge that she'd finally managed to please Father, if only briefly. Not that he said as much, that was not his way, but Rose was perspicacious when it came to recognizing the moods of her parents, if not yet their divining causes. And Father's pleasure had made Rose's own spirits rise as high and as light as one of Cook's soufflés. "With your permission, Lady Mountrachet, I'll finish my examination." Rose sighed as Dr. Matthews lifted her nightgown to expose her stomach. She closed her eyes tighter as cold fingers pressed on her skin, and she thought about her scrapbook. Mama had arranged for a periodical from London with pictures of the latest bridal fashions, and, using lace and ribbons from her craft box, Rose was decorating the scrapbook page beautifully. Her bride was coming along splendidly. A veil of Belgian lace, little seed pearls glued around the rim, pressed flowers for her bouquet. The groom was rather a different matter. Rose didn't know much about gentlemen, and neither should she. It wouldn't be proper for a young lady to know such things. but it seemed to Rose that the specifics of the groom were of little importance, as long as the bride was pretty and pure.
"All looks satisfactory," said Dr. Matthews, patting Rose's nightgown back into place. "Fortunately, the infection is not general. Might I suggest, though, Lady Montrachet, that I speak with you further regarding the best possible treatment?"
Rose opened her eyes in time to catch the doctor's sycophantic smile at Mama. How tiresome he was, always angling for an invitation to tea. The opportunity to meet and treat more of the county's gentry. The published photos of Rose's thimble in situ had garnered him a certain cachet amongst the county's well-heeled, and he'd been quick to capitalize upon it. As he tucked his stethoscope carefully inside his big black bag, patted it into place with his neat little fingers, Rose's tedium turned to irritation.
"Am I not yet headed to heaven, then, Doctor?" she said, blinking plainly at his reddening face. "Only I'm working on a page for my scrapbook, and it would be a shame to leave it unfinished."
Dr. Matthews laughed girlishly and glanced at Mama.
"Well, now, child," he stammered, "there's no need for worry. In time we shall all be welcomed at God's table."
Rose watched for a while as he launched into an uncomfortable lecture on life and death, before turning her head to conceal a faint smile. The prospect of an early death sits differently upon each person. In some, it gifts maturity far outweighing their age and experience. Calm acceptance blossoms into a beautiful nature and soft countenance. In others, however, it allows formation of a tiny ice flint in their heart. Ice that, though at times concealed, never properly melts. Rose, though she would have liked to be one of the former, knew herself deep down to be one of the latter. It wasn't that she was nasty, rather that she'd developed a gift for dispassion, an ability to step outside herself and observe situations without the distraction of sentiment.
"Dr. Matthews,"
Mama's voice interrupted his increasingly desperate description of God's little girl angels,
"why don't you go downstairs and wait for me in the morning room? Thomas will fetch the tea."
"Yes, Lady Maltrachet," he said, relieved to be delivered from the sticky conversation. He avoided Rose's eyes as he left the room.
"Now, Rose," said Mama, "that was ill-mannered of you."
The admonition was diluted by Mama's recent concern, and Rose knew she wouldn't suffer castigation. She never did. Who could be cross with a little girl waiting for death to find her? Rose sighed.
"I know, Mama, and I'm sorry. Only I feel so light-headed, and listening to Dr. Matthews makes it so very much worse."
"A weak constitution is a dreadful cross to bear," Mama took up Rose's hand. "But you are a young lady, a Montrachet, and ill health is no excuse for manners less than perfect."
"Yes, Mama."
"I must go and speak with the doctor now," she said, laying cool fingertips on Rose's cheek. "I'll look in on you again when Mary brings your tray." She swept towards the door, dress rustling as she crossed from rug to floorboards.
"Mama,"
called Rose. Her mother turned back.
"Yes?" "There's something I wanted to ask you."
Rose hesitated, unsure how to proceed, aware how curious her question was.
"I saw a boy in the garden."